Robin here with Tributaries. I was surprised to read in the Oxford English Dictionary that the second definition for ferment is the state of being excited, agitation, excitement, tending to bring about a purer, more wholesome, and stable condition. Today's guest, Sandor Elix Katz, a.k.a. Sanderkraut, is wild about fermentation, and so called his book, Wild Fermentation, the Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods. As you will hear, this declining kitchen art is in good hands, and with a little curiosity and patience, it can be in your hands and kitchen, greatly benefiting your own health as well. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Sander, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much. So, how did you get started venturing into the world of fermentation?
Well, I would say that it started when I was a kid, and absolutely my favorite food as a kid growing up in New York City was sour pickles, brined pickles, and so I always have been drawn to this this sour flavor of fermentation, and I spent a little while following a macrobiotic diet, and that was when I first started learning that there were some very specific health benefits of food with live cultures, that they were enormously beneficial to our digestive processes. But really what got me to learn how to ferment food myself was when I started having a garden, and I learned that, guess what, all of the cabbage is ready at the same time, and you have to figure out something to do with it. And, it turns out that, fermentation processes evolved alongside agriculture. In all forms of agriculture, people have an abundance at a certain moment. And, fermentation is really a strategy for preserving the harvest from the moment of abundance to the seasons of relative scarcity. I began my explorations about 15 years ago, and I've had amazing fun learning to coexist and play with the bacteria.
Now, historically speaking, do you think that's how it all got started? Do you think that man started fermenting foods, obviously you just said, with agriculture? I'm wondering, where do you think the scientific evidence arrived that it was a good idea? I mean, obviously, common sense told every culture on the planet it was a good idea because every culture seems to have taken part in it.
Well, there was really very little scientific understanding of fermentation until the middle of the 19th century with Louis Pasteur. But many different cultural traditions recognized that there was a nutritional importance to fermented foods, and attributed various healing powers, and associated these foods with good health and longevity. So you just find it coming up over and over again in the folklore of different cultures that these foods are particularly healthy. But fermented foods are absolutely ancient. Certainly as agriculture emerged in different parts of the world, people developed at the same time as that techniques for fermenting with the foods that they were growing. But fermentation really is, in all likelihood, even older than agriculture. And, cultural theorists, for instance, Claude Lévi-Strauss, a 20th century French anthropologist and cultural theorist, theorized that when early bands of human beings brought intentionality to the process of creating alcohol, that is one of the sort of first acts of culture. And so the idea is that various animals, other than human beings, it's been documented, periodically enjoy the inebriation of alcoholic beverages when they have the good luck to stumble upon a hive that's washed down in a storm, where the honey's gotten wet and begun to ferment, or berries that begin to ferment on the bushes, or situations like that. But it's when people bring intentionality to it, when they realize that you can empty the hive into a hollowed out section of a tree and add water to it and make that happen. When people bring intentionality to fermentation, that is an act of culture. And fermentation is incredibly old. I mean, all of the oldest written documents in all the various languages where ancient documents survive refer to ferments. I mean, these have been very, sort of central to culture and to culinary traditions all around the world.
Yes, I love, we could easily get off the main path here, but Terence McKenna, his book, Food of the Gods, you know, his whole explanation about how the making of mead was something, perhaps a mistake, trying to use the honey and things as you're describing right now. How do we preserve these sorts of foods? And, you know, I just think that book should have been mandatory reading for every high school student. And now, as science gets started down any road, the details, as you put it, make my eyes start glazing over. And I am in complete agreement with that. But could you share some of the basics regarding the nutritive value of ingesting fermented foods and drink?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are many, many nutritional benefits to fermentation. Fermentation pre-digests food so that, dense compound nutrients get broken down into more elemental forms, that it's easier for our bodies to assimilate. The minerals that are present in various foods become much more bioavailable. Additional nutrients are generated. Ferments typically have higher levels of B vitamins than the raw foods that you start with, and this is because of the life cycles of the bacteria and other microorganisms. Many ferments contain unique micronutrients that are only found in those ferments, and some of which we're beginning to find have enormously helpful functions in our bodies. For instance, anti-carcinogenic compounds called isothiocyanates that are found in sauerkraut, or dipicolinic acid that's found in miso. There are some really important compounds that are generated by the ferments. But the most profound nutritional benefit of fermentation, I would say, is the live cultures that are present in fermented foods that have not been heated after their fermentation. So, fermented dairy products, fermented vegetables, if they still are in their raw, unheated state, then they contain live bacteria which replenish and diversify the populations in our guts, which are really what enable us to digest food and assimilate nutrients in the first place. And then they also play a really important role in our immune function, because they create a competitive situation which makes it difficult for the relatively small number of bacteria which can be pathogenic to us to establish themselves. So, we want, sort of thriving and diverse populations of the kinds of bacteria that we can peacefully coexist with to protect us from the potentially pathogenic ones. So eating the live culture foods in particular has enormous benefit for us, and really all fermented foods are just easier to digest, the nutrients are more accessible, and many of them contain, really unique, special nutrients.
I learned from reading your book, Wild Fermentation, that coffee, tea, and chocolate processing involves fermentation. So does this translate into any benefits that we would get from, say, a sauerkraut?
Not really, because all of those things are cooked afterwards, so you don't get any live culture benefit from any of those. I guess I've seen people experimenting with various forms of raw cacao. I suppose in a raw cacao that could be true, but most of the chocolate that we're eating has been processed. So just because something is fermented does not, guarantee that it has, all sorts of, powerful nutritional benefits. I certainly would not recommend that anybody go on an all-coffee diet itself, even though coffee is fermented.
How do you think the body utilizes store-bought probiotics? I don't know if you want to do it in comparison to live foods, because I think common sense tells us there really is no comparison.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that much about probiotics. My intuitive feeling is that, any nutrient that, we can find in a capsule form, if we find the right foods, we can get it better from foods than we can from capsules. capsule. You know, I think that, you know, eating, incorporating fermented foods into our diet, eating them regularly, it doesn't have to be about eating huge amounts of it, but, you know, eating a little bit of, you know, cultured dairy products, eating a little bit of cultured vegetables, you know, every day is a really effective means of, you know, keeping the flora of our digestive tract
happy,
you know, really in good shape, and you know, and continually replenishing it. See, there's all these factors in our contemporary life, from, you know, chlorine in the water to, you know, antibiotics that we may choose to take as individuals, to the rising level of antibiotic chemicals that are in the water table because of the way livestock is being pumped up with antibiotics. So you know, we really all require this kind of replenishment on a regular basis because our gut microflora is under constant attack.
Well, it's interesting, I think, that as the bacterial products, or antibacterial products, rather, become more and more available and pushed on the society, there's such a rise in asthma and allergies, and there are actually a lot of people that are making connection with these dots here.
Right, sure. I mean, that's called the hygiene hypothesis. You know, there's this idea that, you know, children being kept in overly sterile environments and not having adequate exposure to bacteria is what is, you know, driving this, you know, dramatic rise in, you know, childhood allergies and asthma. So, yeah, that's definitely, that's an explanation that's gaining quite a bit of support. There are other explanations too. I mean, you know, the rise in food allergies just happens to correlate with the introduction of genetically modified foods into our diets. You know, is there a connection? Nobody really knows. You know, there are a lot of you know, plausible explanations, but, you know, we've had so many dramatic changes in our food system and the kinds of foods that people are eating in such a short period of time that you know, as we're seeing a lot of you know, unsettling epidemiological trends in how people are getting sick, it's difficult to you know, figure out what's causing what, because there are so many newfangled introductions and all these foods that have been introduced into our lives, from, you know, trans fats, genetically modified ingredients, recombinant bovine growth hormone, you know, they've just all been introduced without really much study of you know, of their safety and their effect on human beings. You know, that really at this point there's just speculation about, you know, what could be causing these problems. And, you know, incidentally, demographers right now are thinking that children born today are going to have shorter lifespans than their parents. And that's the first time, at least in American history, that that people have ever thought that. And, you know, that's likely to have something to do with the food that we're eating.
Right. I love the phrase or word I saw in your book, rather, eco-immunonutrition. Now, is that your own invention?
That's a word that I found, you know, in the literature. You know,
oh, okay.
There's a lot of literature, a lot of, you know, scientific structured studies that is, you know, looking at the importance of, you know, the microflora in the digestive tract and the various ways that you know, that keeps us healthy. And that word, you'll have to say it because I don't think I can conjure without looking at it.
Well, it sounds like good ammunition to me. I'm wondering if this question will even make any sense, but how do the fermented foods fit in with the way the immune system organizes itself? Is that maybe because the digestive system is sort of one of the first lines of defense there?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. And, you know, I mean, I'm not a scientist. I mean, I know a very limited amount about how the immune system, you know, organizes itself. But I know that it needs the stimulation of, you know, of bacteria. And, you know, that's why this hygiene hypothesis, that's the idea behind this hygiene hypothesis, that, you know, children are failing to develop their immune systems fully because of their lack of exposure to, you know, a range of types of bacteria. And, you know, bacteria are important to us. You know, if you, the scientists who count the cells of our bodies, the cells that reflect our unique individual DNA are outnumbered 10 to 1 by, independent microorganisms that our bodies are host to. If you subscribe to theories of evolution, all forms of life are evolved from bacteria, and no other form of life has ever really successfully lived without bacteria. We're all dependent on bacteria for all these different aspects of our physiological function. And plants can't get minerals out of the soil without the assistance of bacteria and fungi. And similarly, human beings can't get minerals out of the food that we eat without the bacteria in our digestive tract.
Didn't Louis Pasteur say something like microbes will have the last word or something like that? On his deathbed, right?
I think that, anyone who gets involved in the study of microorganisms, just sort of sees that they are ubiquitous, and no matter what happens to all of these sort of higher life forms, the microbes will be there long after we're gone.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit about the process of fermentation for you as you're in your kitchen. I know Sally Fallon made a wonderful quote in her introduction to your book, Wild Fermentation: culture begins on the farm, not in the opera house.
Well, sure. I mean, I think it's fascinating that we use the same word to, describe the bacteria from one batch of yogurt that we transfer to the next batch of yogurt, or the bacteria and yeast that exist in a sourdough that we're seeking to perpetuate. But those are all called food cultures, and the foods that are fermented are called cultured foods. And we use that same word culture to describe language and literature and music and scientific knowledge and, all that which we seek to pass down to the generations. And food cultures turn out to be very intrinsic to human cultures. And when immigrants leave their home country to move to a new land, their food cultures are very often their most cherished possessions that they brought with them, their milk cultures, their sourdoughs, things like that. So, cultured foods are very, very, closely tied in with human cultures. And, as I described a few minutes ago, how the cultural theorist Claude Lévi-Strauss really sees the bringing of intentionality to fermentation, culturing of food, as one of the original acts of culture. It's very intrinsic to human culture. Now, in terms of people reviving it in their own kitchen, I would say that, like every other aspect of food production, fermentation and the culturing of foods has disappeared behind factory doors. Many people no longer understand where their food comes from. One aspect of that is the bacteria that's involved in creating delicious food with the ability to preserve. And yet if you walk into a gourmet food store, it turns out that almost all the foods that we consider to be gourmet foods are the products of fermentation. Cheeses and olives and pickles and, cured meats, salamis, all the condiments that we love are based on vinegar, which is a product of fermentation. The mother of all condiments is fish sauce. But, all the, sort of strong-flavored gourmet foods that people love to eat are the products of fermentation. All around the world, people have fermented their foods to make them more stable and storable and to enable them to themselves to be able to, eat during the seasons of relative scarcity. So fermentation is hugely important. And, right now, it seems to me there's something of a fermentation revival going on. More and more people are, demystifying these processes and learning how to revive them in their own kitchens. I mean, these are ancient rituals that people have been doing for thousands of years, and you don't need a degree in microbiology, and you don't need a laboratory. These can be done by anyone in their home kitchens, and that's really what my book Wild Fermentation emphasizes, how people can reclaim this important process.
Well, I love how you put it. It's the difference or conflict between craft and commerce, which really the repercussions flow out from the immediate home into the community, into the world. And as you put it, the industrialization has sort of put a squash on it, but it's like leaving politics and music to the professionals. We don't want to go there.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think that it's hugely important to you know, to reclaim these. You know, these are really our birthright. I mean, these are cultural traditions. If we want to practice cultural survival, food production needs to fit into that. And we, you know, the explosion in local agriculture and the interest in, you know, in buying local food is part of the same thing. You know, we just need to, you know, figure out how to reintegrate all aspects of food production, you know, back into our communities and back into our lives.
Now,
it's not the globalized food system and the mass production of food. It's not sustainable. It's destroying the earth. It's destroying our health, and it's destroying, any notions of economic security.
Yeah, and I think one thing to mention is that many people are probably thinking, or they would be afraid, they would start growing E. coli or something else that would make them sick. So, could you address that piece? Because it seems like it's pretty harmless, really.
Yeah, well, that's a really widespread fear. I mean, you know, you just have to put that into the context. We are living in a culture which has declared war on bacteria, and there's this generalized idea, which is a lie, that bacteria are dangerous for us. Which is not to deny that there aren't some bacteria that can make us sick. So take the example of E. coli. You mentioned E. coli. Now, it turns out that E. coli is everywhere. Like, you know, you and I and nobody listening to this program has ever taken a breath in our lives where E. coli bacteria did not fill our lungs. It's everywhere. It's in water. It's in the air. It's on our bodies. It's in our bodies. E. coli is harmless. Now, there's a very specific mutation of E. coli that's called E. coli 0157 that occurred in the digestive systems of ruminant animals. That's, you know, cows and goats, animals that evolved with the ability to digest cellulose. But if you take a ruminant animal off of pasture and just feed it grain, then the pH of its digestive system changes, and this has given rise to this mutation of E. coli. So E. coli 0157, this very specific mutation that happened on factory farms, is what can make people sick. E. coli in and of itself is not really a problem. It's just the specific mutation that arose due to the mistreatment of cows in the mass production of milk and meat. So, but nonetheless, they are real dangers. But what we have to understand is fermentation, particularly in vegetables, which is where I encourage people to start, and I have a recipe right on my website, wildfermentation.com. But on raw vegetables, there is such a dramatic preponderance of acidifying bacteria that as soon as you salt the vegetables and get them submerged under liquid, which is the condition that's required to effectively ferment vegetables, then every single time the acidifying bacteria become dominant in that system, and to the extent that there might be any E. coli or any other food poisoning bacteria present, they are killed by the acids that the acidifying bacteria develop. So, you know, fermentation actually is a very, elegant approach which solves a lot of the problems that, that people worry about with food. The fermentation, particularly of vegetables, is extremely, extremely safe. And, sort of none of the food poisoning organisms that you have ever heard of can grow in an acidic environment.
Have you become a salt scholar, considering it's a main ingredient?
I've become more of a salt connoisseur than a salt scholar. I would say that the fermentation organisms turn out to be not that picky about the type of salt that you use. But I think for a far broader set of reasons, it's important that people start to recognize qualitative distinctions among salts, and that the whitest, most refined salts, which are pure sodium chloride, the reason that they're so cheap in the supermarket is that the profits in that industry come from the minerals that they strip away from the sodium chloride that they then sell to the vitamin supplementation industries and the and the animal feed industries. And I think that, using unrefined salts, which typically have a little color, some, pink or red or gray or black color, unrefined salts just contain a much broader spectrum of minerals that's good for us in general, rather than just pure sodium chloride, which most of us are getting too much of it anyway.
Right.
So I think it's just important to make qualitative distinctions among foods.
Do you use the same salt that you would use for fermenting that you would use with cooking?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I use a few different kinds of salts, but the salts that I use, I use interchangeably in fermentation and in cooking. And, they tend to be salts with some color that contain a broader spectrum of minerals.
I'm sure anyone who in their past or perhaps now have ventured into macrobiotics, as you stated, you were originally, know somewhat of the basic process. But, Sandra, why don't you share with us? I mean, basically all you need is salt, water, a cabbage, and a crock. Is that true?
Yeah, and you don't even really need a crock. I mean, a crock is great. I love my ceramic cylindrical-shaped crocks. But, you can do this in a quart-sized jar. A quart-sized jar takes about 2 pounds of vegetables to fill a quart-sized jar. Then you want to grate them or chop them, create a lot of surface area, add a little bit of salt. No need to stress about the amount of salt. Like any other recipe, you can just salt to taste. If you like things with just a little bit of salt, use just a little bit of salt. If you like things salty, use more salt. The tradition for fermentation is to use lots of salt, and if this is, your survival through the winter, then it makes sense to use a lot of salt. But if you're doing this for taste and health benefit, then just salt to taste. It's possible to make it without any salt, and I have some recipes, in my books for salt-free versions of it. But it tastes better with a little bit of salt. Add some salt, any kind of vegetables. Chop your vegetables finely. Then I usually squeeze the vegetables in a bowl with my hands, and what that does is breaks down some cell walls, helps release juices from the vegetables, so you don't have to add tap water. So the liquid that your vegetables are submerged beneath are just their own juices. And then once the vegetables are nice and wet and juicy, then just stuff them in a jar. Just stuff them in and press hard until the more you press, the more the liquid will squeeze out of the vegetables and be able to rise above the vegetables. And the problem is that if the vegetables are exposed to air with oxygen, then you can get molds growing on them rather than these acidifying bacteria. So the way to be sure to get the bacteria growing is to get the vegetables submerged under water, which protects them from exposure to air and thereby protects them from oxygen. You can still get a little bit of surface molding. If you get a little surface molding, just scrape that off. But just keep on, every day or so, press down on the vegetables to make sure they get submerged under water. And then, of course, the big question is, how long do I ferment it for? And you'll have to be the judge of that. What I recommend that people do is give it 3 or 4 days and taste it, but don't eat all of it. And then taste it 3 or 4 days later. And what you find is a progression of flavor. Acidity, sourness, tanginess develops over time. So you have a more mild flavor after 3 days. 3 days later, it's a little bit sharper, and it continues to get sharper over the course of a number of weeks. If you have a cool place where you can ferment it, this can go on for months and months and months. Or you might, many people prefer a mild ferment that just ferments for, some number of days, and then they just eat it or store it in the refrigerator. So there's a lot of sort of subjective judgment that comes into play.
Sander Alex Katz, author of Wild Fermentation. You're a wonderful representation for fermentation. You've got great life force coming out and over through the airwaves here for us today. I thank you. Sander Katz, his latest book, The Art of Fermentation. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.